Hello, and welcome to Light the Way with Dr. Colin Monger. He's the senior pastor of Shepherd of the Hills Calvary Chapel. At Light the Way, we believe the most powerful tool we possess when sharing our faith with others is the Word of God. It was the Apostle Paul that said, "Faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the Word of Christ." So as we open the Word together, it's our prayer that you'll not only receive what God has for you, but share what you learn with those you come in contact with. And now, here's Pastor Colin.
Would you join me as we turn in our Bibles this morning to Genesis chapter 45? Genesis 45. We are finishing a series that we've called From Genesis to Jesus, looking at Jesus coming through all of these big stories in Genesis. We looked at creation, the fall, Noah's Ark, Abraham and Isaac, and now we're looking at the life of a young man named Joseph. And so we conclude our series this morning in Genesis chapter 45. There's an old saying that goes, when it rains, it pours. And we've all heard it. We know that it's talking about something called Murphy's Law. If it can go wrong, it will. I remember when Melissa and I were getting married. I remember all the planning that went into our wedding day. We had chosen this beautiful hotel in downtown Albuquerque to hold our reception. Only 2 weeks before the wedding was supposed to happen, we got a call from them that a bigger group willing to pay more had come along, and so they were bumping us to their sister property across town. Well, we weren't too happy about it being 2 weeks out and all, so we took a ride up to the other hotel, and wouldn't you know that we found that very same kind of room, their banquet hall, was being renovated. And we walked in, and I mean like insulation hanging from the ceilings, and you can see through the walls, all the electrical wires hanging out. There was no carpet, there were no tables, no furniture. All the walls were demolished. There were construction dumpsters all the way around the building. And we looked at the lady that was showing us around and said, "You know, our wedding is in 2 weeks. Is this going to be ready?" And she said, "Well, yeah, it'll be ready. We're on track. No problem. It will definitely be ready for you by the time your wedding comes." And one of the things Melissa kept asking was, "Okay, but what about those ugly dumpsters in the parking lot? Are they still going to be there?" And she said, "No, it's all going to be gone. It'll all be perfect for the wedding day." Well, fast forward 2 weeks, and we're at our wedding day, and we get there, and yes, the room was ready, but as we're walking in, those construction dumpsters were still outside. Earlier that morning, Melissa was trying to move a door stop under one of the doors at the church while they were getting ready, and her foot dislodged it, but then slipped underneath the door itself, likely broke her toe in the process, and she hobbled down the aisle for our wedding. I remember at the reception a few hours later, after we got there and found all the construction dumpsters, one of the kids decided to play a game of hide and go seek, but didn't tell anybody. And so we spent half an hour looking for a lost child in the parking lot and all through the building and all through the hallways. We were calling the police. And so just imagine a wedding reception and the DJ stops the music and all the lights come up and they say, "We've lost a kid." And so that happened. Then the next day, we were supposed to fly out from Albuquerque to go to Orlando for our honeymoon. We had a connecting flight in Dallas, Texas. We got there, and there was a thunderstorm that delayed our connection for like 8 hours. And so they put us in a nearby hotel at midnight in the thunderstorm. We didn't know where we were. We didn't have any toiletries or anything like that. We went down to the customer service desk and had to buy, you know, single-use shampoo, toothpaste, a toothbrush, a comb, and then wake up 5 hours later to go back to the airport. We got on the plane. We got to Orlando only to find out they had then lost our luggage. And so we finally get to our hotel. No luggage, no toothpaste, nothing. Eventually, the bags did show up. So we went on with our trip, and we decided we'd go to the beach, which is the whole reason we were going to Florida. I got to the beach, and I hadn't been there in so long. I ran right into the water, not remembering my cell phone was in my pocket. Well, it died, as you might imagine, and we lost all the pictures that we had taken during the trip because they were on that very same phone. It certainly seemed over those couple of days that if it could go wrong, it did. Murphy and his law had attended our wedding in force. It reminds me of something my dad has always said, and that is, some days are all uphill. And that's how life goes. Sometimes it is all uphill. And no matter what you do or how much you plan or what you try to assume or expect or anticipate or how much you try, you just can't catch a break. But there is something I've learned about hard times. And that is, what we face is not nearly as important as how we face it. In the Bible, it says in 1 Peter chapter 4, don't be surprised by the fiery trial when it comes upon you, as if something strange was happening. The fact of the matter is, we will all face fiery trials. We will all deal with difficulty and challenges, and Murphy and his law will show up. We can choose to let those circumstances do one of two things. They can either make us bitter or they can make us better. But it will ultimately depend on how we respond. But I have also noticed the difference between those two words, bitter and better, is a single word. It's actually a letter, and it is I. If we approach our difficulty from the position of I, from the perspective of, I shouldn't be dealing with this. This shouldn't be happening to me. This isn't fair. After all I've done, why do I have to put up? Why me? Why I? Why this? Why now? If we come from that perspective, that it's all about I, we will become very bitter toward everything. But if you make one little change and you turn the I into an E for Emmanuel, all of a sudden you're looking at that from a whole different angle. Because now it's not about me. Now this is all about God. And it's all about his plan and what he would do and what he's doing through all of this. And so what seemed pointless, looking at it from the perspective of me, gains meaning looking at it through the perspective of God. In the book of James, it says, let the trial have its effect that you may be perfect. And so if I approach adversity from I, it's just going to make me bitter. But if I approach adversity from this is God's plan for me, then that very same event will make me better. If Murphy's law says that if it can go wrong, it will, then Joseph's law says if it can get worse, it will. Because it seems that is the theme of his entire life. Things that could go wrong have, and they have gone from bad to worse. When he was just a toddler, he was on the run from his uncle Laban, who wanted to kill his father and his whole family. A few years later, his mother will die in childbirth. As he grows older, his brothers will grow to hate him so much that they sell him into bondage. Then he's falsely accused of sexually assaulting the wife of a man named Potiphar, who he was serving as a servant in his home. He's then thrown back into prison. He gets forgotten about for about two more years, until eventually Pharaoh calls on Joseph and says, I need your help to lead Egypt through the greatest crisis it has ever seen. And yet somehow, through all of that, Joseph does not let himself become bitter. In fact, to the contrary, all of these things will serve to make him better. And we get to see that through all of this, Joseph continues to serve with integrity. And so by the time we get to chapter 45, Joseph is serving and he's been elevated to second in charge of the entire nation of Egypt. And we see what happens with a right perspective on pain and what that can do in a person's life. Notice what it says in chapter 45, but picking up in verse 4. So Joseph said to his brothers, come near to me, please. And they came near. And he said, I am your brother Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. And now do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God has sent me before you to preserve life. For the famine has been in the land these 2 years, and there are yet 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvest. And God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to keep alive for you many survivors. So it was not you who sent me here, but God. He has made me a father to Pharaoh and lord of all his house and ruler over all the land of Egypt. So just to bring us up to speed as far as Joseph is concerned, because if you remember from last week, the last time we saw this guy, he was running without a shirt out of Potiphar's home after Potiphar's wife came on to him and tried to lure him into an affair, and Joseph refused. Well, apparently she gets so embarrassed and so scorned by being refused by this peasant servant that she accuses him of assaulting her. And Potiphar throws Joseph into prison because of it, which actually might suggest something to us. Joseph wasn't killed for this, and you would think that a servant who had tried to assault the wife of the captain of the guard would certainly be put to death very quickly, except Joseph isn't. And so it almost suggests that maybe Potiphar believed Joseph and not his wife. Maybe he knew his wife. Maybe this wasn't the first time she'd done something like this, but for the sake of face and images and appearances, he had to do something. And so he throws Joseph into prison, sparing him. Well, it's there in prison that he meets two other prisoners, and they come to him and they say, "Joseph, we've had dreams and we want to know what they mean." And so Joseph interprets the dreams. Well, one of them gets very bad news that he'll be put to death. The other one is told that he'll be restored and will serve as the cupbearer for Pharaoh. And it happens the way Joseph said it would. And so then Pharaoh has his cupbearer near him, and one day Pharaoh has a dream. And the cupbearer says, "You know, there was this young man named Joseph when I was back in jail. I'm pretty sure he's there. I don't think anyone's moved him. And I had a dream one time, and he told me what it would be, and it came to pass that way. And so you might tell Joseph what your dream was." So Pharaoh calls on Joseph and tells him his dream. And Joseph said, "Well, here's what the dream means. There will be 7 years of bumper crop and plenty, followed by 7 years of famine. And so here's what you need to do. You need to set aside some of the grain over the next 7 years to help yourself get through the 7 years of famine." Well, Pharaoh is so impressed that he promotes Joseph to second in command of the whole nation. Famine strikes, as Joseph predicted. And then something surprising happens. Joseph's older brothers come down from the land of Canaan because the drought and the famine had affected them too. The only thing is they haven't brought their youngest brother, Benjamin. They left him at home. Well, Joseph knows there's another brother. He hasn't revealed himself to his brothers yet, only he knows who they are. He recognizes their faces, but it's been a long time, almost 20 years. And by this point, Joseph looks like an Egyptian. He speaks like an Egyptian. He has the power of one. And so he knows them, but they don't know who he is. And he says, "Okay, is this all that you have?" And they say, "Well, no, we have another younger brother named Benjamin. But he's so young, we just left him at home." So Joseph said, "Okay, go and get him. Otherwise, I'm going to think you're spies coming in to take what we have." And so he keeps with him one of the other brothers in prison as a hostage, while the others then go and get Benjamin and come back. So they do. They come back with Benjamin, and Joseph says, "Okay, I now believe you're not spies. We'll sell you some grain. You can take it and go." Only Joseph then instructs one of his servants to do something very peculiar. He says, "I want you to take one of my cups, one of the chalices from here, one of the royal pieces, and I want you to put it into his bag." And so he does, which then gives Joseph the cause to stop and arrest Benjamin later for theft. He takes Benjamin back and he tells the brothers, "All right, he stole from me. Now he's going to get separated from you forever," wanting to test their hearts. Are these the same brothers that he remembers? Have they changed? Have they softened over the years? Well, to his surprise, they beg for mercy. They say, "Well, we had another brother, but he died, and father was just stricken with grief. He wouldn't be able to bear it if he lost his other youngest son. So take me in his place, and I'll serve, and I'll give you my life if you just let Benjamin go." And so Joseph is so moved by this compassion that he decides now is the time to reveal his identity. And so he does that in verse 4. He says, "I'm your brother Joseph. I'm not dead. I survived. I'm the one that you sold into Egypt." And notice he goes on in verse 5 and say, "Don't be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me, but God did this to preserve life. Later in verse 7, he said, he sent me to preserve a remnant, to keep alive for you many survivors. And in verse 8, so it wasn't you who sent me here, but God. And so clearly Joseph's experiences have not made him bitter, but rather made him better. And yet I ask the question, how? How is it that after he went through everything he went through, after being betrayed, after losing his freedom and losing many good years of his young life into prison, after doing everything that he's had to do and been through everything that he's had to go through and endure, how is it possible that Joseph doesn't harbor even the slightest bit of anger and bitterness and resentment toward these brothers? Well, the answer is what we said just a few moments ago. Joseph didn't look at any of this through the lens of I, but rather the lens of E. Joseph believed that everything happened because of God, that God had a plan for all of the pain and suffering that he was going through, and Joseph was starting to see all that come together. Which brings us to the very first thing to just notice about this experience. Joseph believed and trusted wholeheartedly, absolutely, without reservation, in God's purpose. He says it in verse 5, don't be distressed or angry with yourselves. God has done this. And then again in verse 7, he echoes the same sentiment. And then at the very end of the book in chapter 50, he says, what you meant for evil, God meant for good, to bring it about that many would be saved. And so Joseph trusted in the purposes of God. He believed that everything he was going through was there for a reason. So often I talk to Christians who are going through something painful in life, and without a doubt, the most common question is why? Why would God allow this thing to happen to me? Why would God take my child? Why would he afflict me with this terrible disease? Why would he afflict my wife or my husband? Why would he let us get married only to not bless us the way he's blessed other people? Why would he make me suffer like this? All I've tried to do is be faithful and serve him, and I do everything he tells me to do, even when I don't understand it. So why is this the reward? What's the point if that's going to be the case? And it's even harder when the person is doing everything well, when they are following the Lord, when they are serving and growing and praying and resisting temptation, when they're working hard at their job and they're honest and faithful to their family and they're patient and loving and enduring and long-suffering. And then when something goes wrong, they go, but why, Lord? What did I do to deserve all of this? And I think it speaks to the basic tendency of every person, believers or unbelievers, and that is to think that at some level, we should be exempt from the suffering of the world, especially with Christians. Because we follow the Lord. We're his children. We're saved by his grace. Jesus went to Calvary for us. He went through all of that so that we wouldn't have to. And so all of this nonsense, Lord, isn't this for the unbelieving world? Isn't this for the people who don't go to church? Isn't this for the ones who aren't praying, who are putting needles in their arms and they're running around on their families? I mean, isn't this for the liars and the cheaters? Isn't this for the people who flaunt you? Isn't this for the people who don't follow Jesus? This is for them, Lord. Why would you let this happen to us? In the book of Job, Job is a righteous man and he's suffering many things because of his faith. And his friends can't seem to grapple with why. Why would someone like Job, of everybody in the world, why would he suffer? God himself said, there's no one like him on all the earth. And so they assume, well, it must be because Job is honestly a bad guy at heart. Yeah, that must be it. I mean, he looks on the surface like he's got it all together, but he must be pretty wicked. And they even tell him that. They say, Job, you know, God is probably giving you less than you actually deserve. Another one of his friends looks at him and says, Job, if you were pure, this wouldn't have happened to you. They just can't understand that righteous people will suffer in life. And if we look at suffering, if we look at pain from the perspective of God is doing this to me, it will inevitably lead to bitterness and resentment and doubting and faithlessness. But if we look at the same thing from the perspective of God is doing this through me, well, that's a very different thing. That's what we see in Joseph when he says here in verse 5, don't be distressed or angry with yourselves. God has sent me before you. You see, the very thing God is doing to us from one perspective is the same thing God is doing through us from another. The purpose of God is a very interesting thing. We usually don't know what it is at the time. We don't know why he lets bad things happen to good people. And it's even harder when it doesn't seem like it makes any sense, because what's the point in letting a little child die of leukemia? How is it that God's great good purpose is served by letting that child have hopes and dreams for the future only to never be able to realize any of them? How is God's purpose served by children being orphaned or murdered? Or what about the hardworking dad who loses his job and his pension? Or the person that spends their life serving others only to die in squalor? And sometimes, and often, when it doesn't make any sense to us, we start asking that question, why? But I'm often reminded of the words of the prophet Isaiah. He said, quoting the Lord, "My ways are higher than your ways. My thoughts are higher than your thoughts, says the Lord." And I have found often in my life that when I don't understand these things, God reminds me that his ways don't always make sense in the world. Jesus said on the Sermon at the Mount, he said, "Blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are the meek. Blessed are the persecuted." That's not a message you're going to hear advertised in the media. Blessed are the abused. They really have a great life. I imagine that's not going to be in the headlines. Blessed are the ones who can't get enough to eat. Boy, they should be grateful. That's not a message the world would give us. And yet Jesus said, no, their reward will be great. God will touch their life in a very special way. And then, after enough time, when we see the results, it starts to make sense. We see the purpose of God, and we see how it was at work all the time. With our kids, sometimes we tell them things, and we don't give them all the details right away. And they don't understand. And for whatever reason, we don't tell them. It could just be because it's too much for them, we don't have time. Maybe we just want them to obey. It could be just because I don't want to. You know, I'm just in that kind of a mood. Just because I said so and I'm a parent and you live here and breathe air in my house. And sometimes that's honestly it. And you know, if you're a parent, sometimes that is it. Just clean your room. Why? Because I said so. But often the question is why? Why do I have to? Why do I? Why can't I? Why? And usually, more often than not, the answer is because. Just trust us. We know what we're doing. We're your parents. Been alive a little bit longer than you. We've seen this. We were born during the day, but not yesterday kind of thing. It's going to be a good thing. Just do what we're asking you to do. I think of those times when I think about the purposes of God in my life, and often when I want to ask, why, God? Why me? Why this? And how many times God simply says, because. Just trust me. I know what I'm doing. I declared the end from the beginning, after all. My ways are higher than your ways. Just trust me. In the book of Habakkuk, the prophet says from God, I am doing a thing in your generation that you would not believe if I told you. And so when you get an answer like that, there's not much we can do except be patient. But then eventually the purpose is revealed. And that's one of the beautiful things about faith. Time is on your side. If you wait long enough, God will reveal his purpose to you. And then usually I find myself going, oh, so that's what was going to happen. Oh, so this is why all of that other stuff had to go first. I never would have guessed that. In my entire life, I never could have imagined something like that. And I usually feel the Lord convicting him, going, yeah, I know you wouldn't understand. I set that. I kind of wrote that down. I'm doing a thing that you wouldn't believe me if I told you. I told you you wouldn't get it. That's why I didn't tell you about it. So just trust me. My ways are higher than your ways. And so with Joseph, I'm sure there are times he questioned, why, Lord, why me? Back in chapter 40, he was still in prison. And he was in there with a couple of the other prisoners, and one of them was about to be released to become the cupbearer of Pharaoh. And he looks at this young man and he says, I was stolen out of the land of the Hebrews, he tells him. I've done nothing that I should be put in this pit. And so his one request is, look, I've done this for you. When you get to Pharaoh, just remember me. And so no doubt in that, we hear Joseph questioning, why, Lord? I've done nothing that I should be put into this pit, and yet here I am. And now it's all happened. Now we get to chapter 45, and Joseph is seeing it all come together. Everything's been revealed, and he sees the purpose of God. And so he says in verse 5, don't be distressed with yourselves. Don't be angry with yourselves. Yeah, you were the mechanism, but God is the one who sent me here before you. And so Joseph trusted the purpose of God. Second, he understood the providence of God. Notice in verse 7, he says, God sent me before you to do some things. Notice what they are. To preserve for you a remnant on the earth and to keep alive for you as many as possible. In verse 8, he made me a father to Pharaoh. It's a spiritual father to Pharaoh, a lord of all his house and a ruler over all the land of Egypt. And so Joseph sees how God has been using all of these things. For the believer, there is really nothing more exciting than seeing the miracles of God. And we love miracle stories. We love when somebody had cancer and the doctor said it was stage 5 and they're not going to live much longer and make their final preparations for the end of their life and that kind of thing. And then they go back a week later and miraculously all of the tumors are gone and they go on to live many more years. We love stories like that. We love stories of somebody who survived something and they shouldn't have, or stories where somebody was praying for a spouse or a child or a friend or a loved one to come back to the Lord, and by all estimation, they never were going to, and then God does something out of the ordinary that grabs their attention and brings them back. We love those kinds of stories, and I will tell you that I believe God still does miracles. I think that we pray for miracles. I think we ought to pray for miracles. But I don't think he usually does miracles. That's why they're called miracles. If he did them all the time, they'd be called normals. But they're not called normals. They're called miracles. By definition, God sets apart the natural law of things to do something supernatural that he wants to do and can't do any other way. And so that's a miracle. But God doesn't usually do miracles. Usually he operates within the scope of the creation that he's made, and we call that providence. It's where he brings all things together that we could never have imagined, and yet they all work together in a way. God works through natural means, more than supernatural means. It was C.S. Lewis who said it this way. God seems to do nothing himself which he can possibly delegate to his creatures. He calls us to do slowly and blunderingly what he could do perfectly and in a twinkling of an eye. God could have given the law to all of Israel by himself verbally. And he could just shout it down from heaven. They all would have heard the same thing at the same time. No confusion. In fact, the very name Israel means that it's led by God. Isra means ordered. El refers to God. And so we see it is ordered by God. And so this is his personal nation. These are his people chosen by him to be a people of his own purposes and through whom the world will be blessed. And so he certainly could have done it that way and it would have fit with the name that he gave them. But he didn't. Instead, he used Moses and the prophets. And he used the preachers, and he used the tribe of Levi throughout the years. God could have grown his church on his own, just snapped his finger, and there it is. But he didn't. Jesus instead says he'll build his church, but he tells us, go and preach the gospel to every creature. God could have written the Bible himself, but he didn't. He used more than 40 human authors, over 1,500 years, three different continents, and four different languages to communicate his message to us. And all of them have their own personality and their own backstory and their own quirks and their own ways of looking at things. We have four gospels all talking about the same person and his ministry, and they have so many different details. God could have sent Jesus through divine teleportation. I mean, he could have just appeared in the world. So many other times God or an angel does just appear, but he doesn't. He sent his son, born of a woman, born under the law. And although the conception was miraculous, the gestation, the pregnancy, was completely normal. And when the time had come for Mary to give birth, it tells us that it was a normal amount of time. In the book of Romans, it says in chapter 8 that God works all things together for the good. And so Joseph is no doubt looking at everything that's happened. He takes a step back and he sees the providence of God.
You've been listening to Light the Way with Dr. Colin Munger, the senior pastor of Shepherd of the Hills Calvary Chapel. If you'd like to hear this message again, stop by our website at lightthewayradio.org. Not only will you find an archive of Pastor Colin's teachings there to listen to, but there you can find out more about our ministry. Jesus said, "You are the light of the world," and we want everything we do and say to revolve around that. If you'd like to get behind what we're doing, please visit lightthewayradio.org. Thank you for listening today, and come back next week as Dr. Colin Munger once again delivers another helpful message from God's Word to help us light the way. In the meantime, remember to be a light to someone this week.